All right, our next speaker is Justin Blum from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sorry, Justin, I lost your bio. He's a hydrologist, again, with Minnesota Department of Health in the Wellhead Protection Area. He's worked with Minnesota state government for over 30 years, and he was a consultant for 8 years prior to his work with state government. He has a BA and an MS in geology from the University of California. Most things that he has worked on, he claims to be an early adopter, which I believe is true. And those early adoptions include groundwater flow modeling, GPS, GIS, which now he claims others have taken over because they do it better. And the only subject area that he has not yet thoroughly been disrupted is the aquifer test and analysis, which is what he will be talking about today. Welcome, Justin.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I think this is the first talk I've given the MGWA conference in a few decades. So it's got to happen sometime. We got our eyes on you youngins. So let's see if I mastered the technology of this yet, right? My background started out more as geophysics, and so I started looking at aquifer test analysis perhaps a little bit differently than other people. I tend to geek out about these things. So you'll have to bear with me. But I really worked hard to not talk about any aquifer test analysis techniques, any curve matches, any linear regressions, any of that stuff. You're not going to see that today. So relax. It's just going to be hopefully entertaining. Let's see if I get this right here. Okay, topics. I'm going to talk about the documented tests we have on file in what we call the aquifer test database. It's a brief history of testing in Minnesota, notable unusual historic tests, this would be advisedly, you know, take it under advisement, recent developments in data collection methods, because I graduated to a smartphone only about 3 years ago. So, need to develop methods to deal with we don't have big data here in Minnesota, except maybe we're verging on big data with some of the stuff that MGS is doing. But bigger data in terms of the size of the data sets that we have for our hydrology. So I'm just gonna call that bigger data. And then an appeal to bring out your tests, because there's a lot of good information in people's files that's not seen the light of day since you reported it to your client or filed your report. No deep weeds in this presentation. This is the only deep weeds you're going to see. Relax. This is a descriptive, more of a descriptive talk about what the data set is like and what it's about. So to get started, when I started in wellhead protection at the health department in 1990, there really was no master list of tests. Back in the day, Bruce Olson contracted with the USGS to go through their files and the files of the DNR, mostly. To compile a list of tests, and they came up after a year or so of plunking through that very exciting set of paper. They came up with a list of existing tests, and it was 478 of them. And it was basically an index with some aquifer properties associated, a TRS location, a date, maybe a pumping rate, transmissivity, storativity, things like that, and an analysis method. And we since have added to that, and right now we have a tally of about 1,500 tests in the data set. And most of those tests actually are ones from other sources. We've added a bunch of our own tests, of course, but those doing tests is very resource intensive, just put it that way. And as the data are currently in Microsoft Access, which is basically dying. Possible number of tests per year versus what we have in the data set, well, if we do take some rough numbers of how many high capacity wells are being put in the state, it ranges for community wells maybe between 30, round number 20 of them, and then depending on economic conditions and whether it's a drought or other conditions, that you might end up with between 100 and 400 high capacity wells being put in for irrigation and other purposes. The DNR does tests themselves for permits, or forces people to do tests for permits, and does it for interference complaints and resource assessments, and they're probably somewhere on the order of about 10 tests per year there. That they do themselves, MPCA remedial investigation work. We're not sure how many tests. Well, MDH does groundwater models for maybe 50 communities a year, so we'll scratch around and find some kind of information for our models, and a lot of those will not be full-on tests, maybe specific capacities, but let's just say round numbers 50. Including the tests that I would do. Generally, that's been running about 5 per year. And the USGS research, I'm not sure. But gross estimate, let's say round numbers, about 300 tests per year. Well, if we took that out for 25 years, we'd be looking at 7,500 tests. We've got maybe 20% in the data set. So we're only capturing a fraction of what's going on. So in some respects, with this data set, we're looking at the way we were in terms of geology or a lot of the other things that have been described earlier in the earlier talks a couple decades ago. We have a long way to go. And for those who like maps, I'll show there's a spatial bias in the tests, in the documented test locations. So here we have roughly the 1,500 tests, and the red dots, and then these are the community at 2,900 roughly active community public water supply wells, and you can see the road network easily. You can see there's a strong correlation between where the blue dots are and the red dots are, based on our priorities as an agency. And then here is, just for contrast, is roughly the 8,000 active irrigation wells in the MPARS data set. And you can see there's the correlation is less strong, let's put it that way. So roughly, counting the number of high capacity wells that are out there, we're looking at maybe 10% in the current, we should be upwards of 15,000 tests rather than 1,500 if we were actually capturing any significant portion of the data that is being generated. The benefits of actually maintaining a data set like this is that, one, it's a means to record your work if you're actually doing this kind of work yourself. It's also then gives people who are more, say, statistically oriented ways to look at estimates of aquifer property statewide. Many times we only have a reference to a document or a file or a report. It give you something to start a file search to dig deeper. If you are generating a flow model, you'd want to be able to cite the source of your aquifer parameters that you're using in your model development. And it's a potential time and cost savings, because if somebody else has already done it, why do you have to do it? The current status of the aquifer test database is it's basically dead. The reason why is because my department decided that the priorities were not that strong to keep it in-house, even though we had started it. We're not going to upgrade it to enterprise standards. So in other words, Oracle or Postgres or anything equivalent. So that decision was made, and then what are we going to do with it? So we put together a work group and the usual suspects, Department of Health, Geologic Surveys, both state and federal, Pollution Control Agency, DNR, and the Met Council all participated. We met. It was a very efficient work group. Met for 6 months. Developed a needs assessment and a data model for a revised data set, and disbanded. Well, it took a little while, as things do, but DNR has, at the time, stepped up and said that they would take it over. It fit their mission, which I agree. They're committed to the next generation aquifer test database, but of course they'll be their own flavor. I won't have much to do with it. The new data set will be called the Aquifer Properties Database, because we're starting to put things in there other than just tests, other measures of aquifer properties or the properties of geologic materials. Okay, fine, I can live with that. And then, of course, the Oracle DBA said, oh, we can't have any data set with the name test in it, because we'll delete it without thinking. So. And my response was, after a protracted rant in email, was they need to get out more. The data schema was changed slightly for DNR's needs. Basically, you know, I have the luxury at the health department most of the time discharging the well into a distribution system. I don't have to worry about what's the condition of the discharge pipe and where does it go and did it leak and, you know, was it actually discharging far enough away that I don't have to worry about it influencing my test? That is something that DNR has to worry about. So that was the main addition there in terms of the schema. And then, of course, it got turned into the data model got it's quite baroque at this point because of it's going to be a web application. So it's got all kinds of other fancy things in there. I am happy to announce programming has started. So this is, the clouds have parted, the God ray descends, and okay, put on your dark glasses, here it comes. This is good. Test types in the current and new databases, it's the classic constant rate aquifer test that you all know and love. With observation wells. That's what it's optimized for in terms of the data schema. Also production tests, you know, variable rate, step tests, all that kind of stuff easily accommodated. It doesn't include slug tests right now and specific capacity and or geophysical flow logging kinds of things. The reason that we don't have those test types in there is slug, and generally, that was not our priority, even though it'd be easily accommodated. When you look forward and we need to be testing low K material, sure, you're going to want to have slug tests in there. Specific capacity, well, that's carried in CWI already, so why duplicate? The geophysical flow log is managed by MGS, so we don't have to worry about that much. until we try and make our data fit whatever it is that they're doing, which I have not been paying attention to. And the quality of tests of record, well, that becomes more of an issue. We have, a lot of different types of tests in there of different provenance, a different age, a lot of production tests, basically run by a driller, and that's it. That's all we've got. And then we've got full-on aquifer tests with, perhaps even 20 observation wells. So it's all over the map there. But as unique well numbers is an indicator of overall quality, it started out with perhaps half of the tests in the index did not have a unique number. And then we've spent the last 20 plus years figuring out unique numbers for many of those tests. Right now, out of the 1,500 tests, 63 remain without unique numbers. And then as we talk about the overall tip, the topic of data quality, I want to take a little ramble, a little diversion into the moral hazard of data collection and management. People were laying out bets for my talk whether I'd bring up the topic of dark data. And I decided to do them one better and generate a whole lexicon, a vocabulary of test types. And I started poking around, and there's this period of time in Western civilization when it was really popular to ascribe human qualities to animals and then use that as a cautionary tale or morality teaching device. And it was called a bestiary. And don't do that on the internet. that will not be safe. I found this in the walled garden of Wikipedia, so I felt okay. But and I'm going to adapt the bestiary of test types through the lens of popular culture to dead, which is bad, dark, which is very nearly dead. A stub is barely alive, and live, it's possibly good, but we have to check it first. So moral character of a dead data is equivalent to the Monty Python skit about the dead parrot. No one knows that there was a test, but for a file in a box, and it's essentially not worth much. The moral character of dark data is dark. There was a test, but only you know that it occurred, and you need Miracle Max to breathe some life back into it, because it's only mostly dead, not all dead. And then a test stub, again, apologies to Monty Python, is it 'tis only a scratch. You have minimal documentation, a unique number, a date. Who did the test? Perhaps maybe the only thing's known. And it's basically, something happened, but you're not sure exactly where, maybe. The Dark Knight is courageously fighting on without quite all of his parts. And then if it's a live test, then you know that you actually can dive into it. You've got the full documentation, the data, the hydraulic properties that were analyzed by what methods, and therefore you can perhaps even reanimate it, as in Young Frankenstein. So, on that note, now we have the vocabulary to talk about the state of our aquifer test database. The majority of tests in the data set are stubs. Maybe half or single well production tests. All data associated with about 250 tests, the health department ran, has been entered. But in terms of files, we have roughly 22 gigs of test data, documentation, whatever, in a more or less accessible file structure on our network drive. And then, of course, the other agencies are in the process of scanning their files. God knows when they'll be finished. And or make the files known to us so that we can actually scrape the data out of them. Primary sources of test data, of course, are well drillers, service companies, and well owners. I call well zero, since all databases these days start with zero, to be the 2,200-foot deep well in a park in Mankato that was drilled in 1875. So we can start from there. And then the Department of Natural Resources started issuing appropriation permits in 1938. However, the enabling legislation for the interference complaint process didn't go into effect until the mid-70s, so I would not expect to see a whole lot of interference complaint type testing in their files older than that. The USGS, the earliest tests that I could find that they had published were in 1948, and geotechnical engineering firms and the MPCA started getting going in the 1970s. And of course, we at the Health Department didn't really get going until our own testing until 1993. Occasional sources of data: University of Minnesota, Agricultural Extension has some test data. I just know it exists, I don't have it on hand. The Geosciences Department has some, particularly associated with the Hydro Field Camp or any of the other work that they're doing. Say, for instance, that was mentioned earlier on campus. And then geotechnical engineering firms, the Department of Geotechnical Engineering may have some data. And then U.S. Corps of Engineers and Johnson Screen also have contributed some. Completely untapped sources of data might be irrigation system sales and service companies, and anybody in the audience who may have some dark data. As I was preparing for this talk today, I was asking around my acquaintances and found out there was a year-long pump test run up in Crookston in the 70s, and I'd never heard of it. Well, what happened to that? Well, it was a court case. Well, there's got to be a record. Where the heck is it? That's that type of thing. So we just need to bring out your tests, please. So here's the earliest published hydraulic testing that I could find. It's from the Corps engineers preparing for the lock and dam system in 1939. And they, were doing tests on quarried blocks of St. Peter and then looking at sieve analyses, et cetera. This is a curve published in 1963 for the tests at Camp Ripley that were conducted in 1948 and 49. USGS has got to have a whole warehouse full of documents of their tests. They've got at least 100 publications concerning estimates of aquifer properties, and this is just one for the area around Appleton, water supply paper 2039B. There's a significant effort that required to find the unique number to associate with a particular result based on the public land survey coordinates and date drilled use capacity, that type of thing. And usually the data were not published. The DNR had a cooperative relationship with the USGS for decades doing groundwater resource assessment, and that's where a lot of the work was done historically. And then, as I said, the interference complaints started in the 70s, but very, very few published results. There are probably only two documents I'm aware of from DNR that have test results in them. One is selected to OCC for tests in 1980. The other one was also had to do with Swift County in 1980. Lots and lots of data still in the DRNR files. Notable exotic historic tests. This is feather boa time. This is different setup. So the DNR permitted Mitigasco for the Waterville Underground Gas Storage Facility. Probably many of you don't know that where your natural gas is stored seasonally that you use to heat your homes. This is a storage facility that was developed in the 60s, pre-code. It is similar to the one that had a blowout in Southern California last year, except that that reservoir that blew out was an old played out oil reservoir that they now are using for gas storage. This one was a water reservoir, basically, that was developed for that purpose, and your low gas rates partially reflect the use of that facility, because otherwise they'd have to build a much, much bigger pipeline. So they have a smaller pipeline, and then they pump the gas into this storage reservoir, and then it comes out and is delivered to your home and businesses. And then after the energy crisis, there were some interesting tests that were done. One was the aquifer thermal storage 80s tests at the University of Minnesota campus, and then also the DOE funded a test of a bunch of water table wells up in Staples. They put 10 wells in on a grid and then developed them with different techniques and different constructions, and then tested each one in turn multiple times. So that one's kind of an interesting setup. I stumbled on this Waterville test just by poking around CWI. I was looking at deep holes in south central Minnesota, my area, in terms of wellhead protection. And I found maybe about 100 test holes that were drilled up to 3,000 feet deep. They predated the well code, had geophysical logs, and some had been converted to DNR obwells. What the heck is going on? So I called people I knew, and I got a well record or two. And here's an example well record. Obviously, it's not an official Department of Health form. And what the heck? It's got a drill stem test on it. And I had not seen a drill stem test since I moved to Minnesota and stopped doing anything associated with the oil field. Well, what is a drill stem test? It's an oil field equivalent of a slug test. It's quick, affects small volume of aquifer. It's essentially a short constant rate flow period and longer recovery, what they call a shut-in. And it's the analysis technique is adapted in a most peculiar petroleum engineer way, from TICE recovery, T over T prime. Or in 1980, Agarwal, who's an oil field guy, rephrased it, and you can use his method and actually get a storativity off of it. So that's why we use the Agarwal method. But enough about DSTs. So here's the location of the facility. You can see it down in kind of the northern part of Waseca County, right up against Le Sueur County and Rice County. And this is a map from the DNR files as to the structure contour of the Mount Simon in that area with the approximate extent of the seasonal gas storage. This is of interest to me, because how many times do we have an opportunity to get hydraulic properties from the Mount Simon in the middle of the Hollandale embayment, or close to the middle? This is it. So it was worth time and effort to exhume the data. And it took about 5 years after I asked Jenny to, well, where are those files? And so she had the boxes pulled and got things scanned. Thank you, DNR. And turns out that the Minnegasco DNR had contracted with Dr. Paul Witherspoon to supervise testing the anachronal structure. And as usual, and when you're working at that level, Witherspoon and Neumann proposed this type of use of the technology in a monograph that was published around that same time for using aquifer tests to qualify underground natural gas storage systems. So they ran a 60-day gas injection test from September to December on one well, injecting that at that wellhead at 300 psi pressure and roughly 1 million cubic feet per day of gas. This is the scanned data record. What they had was, my brain is blanking on the technology, but it was the old strip chart recorder with you wind up with a clock with the a float that goes down the well, and that. Thank you, and yes, I am getting old, and they transcribe that here one reading per day at noon. So I redigitized that data, and this is the. Let's see if I can use the. Oh, yes, there is a mouse. Does that show up? Oh, yeah, cool. All right, so this is the trace of the gas injection, the start of gas injection. And here on the little blue, light blue dots, and this is a trace from one of the nearby Mount Simon completions where the gas actually broke through. And so they were creating a bubble of gas in the aquifer. And this is roughly the size of that bubble. I'm sure it actually was a bit different than that because there's some orientation of that anticline. But you can see there that over 2 miles away, these farther away observation wells here and here and here all reacted roughly 5 feet of water level difference. And the farthest away well that reacted was roughly 19,000 feet away. So that test affected a huge area. And this roughly is the size of the previous figure overlaid on top of the structure contour map. This reservoir is functioning right now. It contains billions of cubic feet of natural gas that cycled in and out every year. The difficulty for this analysis was just figuring out the injection rate in terms of water. I'm not a petroleum engineer by any stretch of imagination, so if anybody has that kind of chops, I'd love to hear about it, get a better idea of what whether or not my calculation of the injection rate is right or not. That was a valuable enough pile of data to go through the process of resurrecting it. So bring out your tests. It can oftentimes contain a lot of usable data, and it's sure useful to get the data that somebody's already collected rather than having to do it yourself. More recent data developments in data collection technology more have to do with mobile technology. Apologies to the John Dustman in the previous MGWA talk where he talked about the Internet of Things. I'm just talking about stuff that's under my control, like one of these devices. So if you want to use your social coordination device for science, feel free. And then the increasing use of data acquisition control systems, which they typically call SCADA, which is just a word, by well owners and operators. And it's kind of like Exxon. You know, they made up a word, so it would be not offensive to anybody in any language. So, SCADA's data collection has some real common issues. Right now, because of the data standards and why they're collecting the data, DNR is driving it really by their monitoring group, and it currently does not include the actual start-stop time of the pump. And I can understand why the monitoring group would not be that focused on that, given that surface water type stuff is non-point. Groundwater is distinctly point, and so that needs to be fixed. And I hear that it is in process, so that's good. The programming of the SCADA systems is very specialized and costly. I'd like to have that billing rate of that guy who does that work. And the data displays are not self-documenting. In other words, you might see a number on the panel, but typically it doesn't have a date time on it. What were they thinking? All right. Poor quality, and then the other thing is really that, and this is more of a, have to put it in context that what these sensors are used for is day to day, day in, day out, is to fill tanks and to make sure that the well is functioning the way it's supposed to. So I don't want to sound super critical, but I really wish that they would spend the extra 10, 20, 50 bucks per sensor to upgrade to something that is minimum sensitivity of plus or minus a tenth of a foot at least. There are many instances I've come across where it's plus or minus a foot. The worst one I think I've seen is plus or minus 7 feet. So basically that's only good for telling you when the well is on. That kind of stuff, at least we're making progress in terms of having real data, time series being collected. So we can request, everyone say please, MDNR to improve the monitoring data format. Yeah, I think that's in process. And then the well owners to upgrade their sensors. But it's in terms of what we can do for ourselves, back to basics. And, what did they do in the old, because generally there's very few things that are new. So while we're waiting for the Internet of Things to resolve itself, I call it the thingy net, we've got these phones in our pockets, what they call phones, actually, they're little computers. Here's a USGS water supply paper, 1961, a movie camera, and a stopwatch, and a manometer, and a discharging well. Well, there we go. It's already been thought of. I can't patent it. So this is what I started doing a couple years ago when I realized I actually could use this thing for something useful other than making it so my dear spouse could get a hold of me at any time, I put an egg timer on the totalizing flow meter and started taking pictures. It was a whole lot easier than trying to write stuff down because I flip digits all the time. This is my version 2 where I pulled the date time captured from the photo file header information and put it on there, but it still has a problem. In that it's not easy to use. So I need a improved method. It needs to be automatic, pretty rapid, and self-documenting. So is there an application out there that will do that? So, I scrolled through the and figured out that way to waste time and spend money. Most of the applications out there are for putting faces, distorting people's faces, and really useful things. You know, which I'm sure, well, I won't go there. But what I found was, yes, there is an app for that. So your cost of your mobile device is about, say, $200 if you're not an early adopter like me. And the incremental cost of this app is $1. I think I can afford that. And I don't know whether it's available on Android devices. It's a little bit tricky to use, I think. I would prefer to have a digital way to set the time rather than these stupid slider bars, but that's just me. And, you know, dexterity. Yeah. And there you go. Repurpose equipment you already own. You've got that selfie stick that you got for the holidays. You got the camera tripod gathering dust in your closet because nobody uses cameras anymore. And yeah, hey, what the heck? You've got that duct tape, and pretty soon you're in business. And it works great. And so these are two photos at 5 second on a 5 second interval, and it's showing water levels from the display panel on a recent test, and that I ran in St. Louis Park in January this year. And it's a lot easier to transcribe because the photo, you can change the interval in the photos. Obviously, you're not going to be taking 5 second data all the whole time. But, you know, for that time interval, it's at a uniform interval. It's easy, much easier to get in the spreadsheet. It's not set and forget. Digital displays time out often, and you'll have inadvertent selfies stuck in there. And a note to the data collectors, please record the difference in time between your mobile device and the SCADA system. Oftentimes, they're not the same. And in terms of the SCADA systems in general, all of the things that can go wrong with a pumping test and transducers and things like that occur. But they're under someone else's control, not yours. So you really have to, you know, work hard to develop a relationship with the water operator and you know, work with them to say, okay, what's going on with this sensor? You turn on this well over here and nothing's happening here. Is your sensor working? Well, I don't know. Well, could you check that, please? And so we went through multiple iterations of that type of issue in order to make sure that everything was working as best as possible. It's pretty normal because really what their two goals are keep the city council off their back and make the state health department go away and keep that tank full. You really have to bear that in mind when you're working with the operators. Oftentimes there's electrical problems. I've had situations where I turn the well on and the whole, it's like the offset on the transducer just jumped 40 feet. So there's some kind of stray current going on. I have no idea. I'll just try and use that data as best I can. And then oftentimes there's computer or database control system issues where the whole data series is inverted so that they say, yeah, it's supposed to be elevation such and such, but actually water levels go up, or water elevations go up when you turn the pump on. Well, obviously that's not the case. So there's all kinds of little gotchas in there. Here's an example of recent SCADA series time data that I got to work on with Dave Shearer at PCA on the contaminant issues in Edina and St. Louis Park. It's just a subset of the data just for those wells in northeast Edina, so that there are just the city wells there. There are only two wells that are pumping on this plot. And you can tell, where's my, yes, it's the wells that are down here. the magenta and the orange. And those wells pretty much are driving the whole system. I selected a portion of that data set to analyze with conventional methods. What I found was remarkable, which was that we have an observation well over here in St. Louis Park in the Prairie du Chien that's over 2 to 2.5 miles away from the pumping wells that is clearly responding to what's going on at these distant pumping wells. And so that has a real impact. That, you know, usually we're looking at the extent of detectable change in water levels, maybe 2 miles. This is easily detected much farther than that. So if you don't look at the data, you won't ever find out these weird things. It depends on the foundational data sets, wells, water use, and water level. But we do need better tools to analyze. It needs to incorporate the multiple pumping wells and observation points, well efficiency and leakage. And then I've got a set of possible tools to start developing from. Bring out your tests. And these are also from the BC area. Those are hedgehogs rolling in grapes to take back to their burrow to feed their young. So.
We're going to skip questions for now, but Justin will be back after lunch for panel discussion.